Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 05-5284, Frank A. Skinner, Appellant versus United States Department of Justice et al. Ms. Williams from Amicus Curiae, Mr. Nebaker for the Appellees.
Ms. Williams.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Yvonne Williams, and I'm here as amicus on behalf of Mr. Skinner. This case arises from a motion to dismiss granted by the district court, and is primarily about whether the district court erred when it concluded that the Privacy Act exemption regulations precluded Mr. Skinner's claims for damages and injunctive relief. The case, however, also raises the issue of whether Mr. Skinner sufficiently stated a Privacy Act claim for damages, which was a later ruling by the district court. We believe the district court erred in both orders and will address them both in turn here. By way of background, Mr. Skinner was found guilty, who's currently a prisoner in the federal penitentiary system. He was found guilty by the Bureau of Prisons of possession of paraphernalia on January 28, 2002, after a prison shakedown that occurred on November 21, 2001. Where the BOP claimed to have found a substance which tested positive for cocaine in Mr. Skinner's locker. Upon being found guilty, Mr. Skinner was, among other things, placed in segregation or solitary confinement for several months, discounted 40 days of good time credit, and denied commissary privileges for 180 days as well as visitation privileges for 360 days. Now, at the time he was adjudicated guilty, he, under the Privacy Act, had a right to challenge whether the content of his prison records were accurately maintained under the Privacy Act. Section 552A(e)(5) of the Privacy Act requires that agency maintain all records used by an agency in making any determination with such accuracy, relevance, timeliness, and completeness as is reasonably necessary to assure fairness to the individual in the determination against him. The Privacy Act also grants agencies authority to exempt themselves from this requirement. Now, the BOP issued its exemption regulations for Section 552AE5, the statute under which Mr. Skinner has brought his claims, on August 9th, 2002.
Could we just pause for 1 second? It's clear that they have exempt amendments, right?
Yes.
Okay, so the only issue here goes to damages?
Well,
they can't amend. Right, because that's exempt. That's what we said in White. Is that not right?
Right. Now, then he's not seeking to amend. He's seeking damages for
yes,
failing to accurately maintain his prison record file.
For that, he has to show intentional failure to maintain the correct records. Right.
Yes.
And in what way was this intentionally not accurate?
Well, what we had articulated in our brief is that at the time when the shakedown occurred, Mr. Skinner had pending before the Bureau of Prisons a complaint of assault against one of the guards who was involved in the shakedown. He also has pled in his complaint and his other pleadings that there's vindictive attitudes, I think those are his words specifically, towards him.
If there were vindictive attitudes and if they were biased against him because of the assault, then the decision that he had the cocaine would be improper, right? They'd have to redo that because that's what the Supreme Court said in Balasag.
That they may not have to redo that. It may not be improper. It may be that with all of the records in place, including the document that Mr. Skinner focuses on primarily, which is the referral form, which is in the record at 8:30. That document, had it been in the records, there would, at a minimum, be contradictory results there. So there would be a notation on a referral form that we believe could have been written by the FBI that said that the substance in question was actually launched.
So that calls into question the validity of the rescission of his good time credits, right?
No. We think that what it does is it challenges the other forms of punishment that he had, the solitary confinement, the segregation, the denial of commissary privileges. It doesn't necessarily go to the denial of good time credits.
Why is that? Why would the segregation be different? Under what theory would the segregation be different from the denial of good time?
Because it would be a claim for damages.
What was the reason for segregation?
Because he was found guilty.
Of having cocaine in his, of it.
Right.
Right.
That's the same reason for the denial of good time credit.
Right. Isn't that the same?
Right, but if you have this document that says that there may be an FBI, another agency thought that it was actually laundry detergent, then you have conflicting evidence. And so with conflicting evidence, maybe the hearing officer below could have said, well, we're not going
to... Your answer to Judge Garland's question should have been yes. It does go to good time credit. It also goes to these other...
Well, that's true. I'm sorry. You're right. It does go to both, but that doesn't mean that... Well, I think what we're going to is the habeas question. It doesn't mean that everything has to then go through habeas, because that's not where we are. He's challenging damages, and he has a right to challenge those challenges, to challenge that confinement as a damages question under the Privacy Act, and he is not exempted from doing so.
He can't get the damages unless he shows that he's improperly determined to have lost good time credits or improperly segregated or any of those things, right?
Right.
And the only way it would be improper is if he didn't have cocaine.
Well, let me backtrack. What he could show is that if his record were accurately maintained, there was contradictory evidence, and the hearing officer could have said...
from that. What injured? In what way was he injured by contradictory evidence except for the fact that he was segregated, that he lost his good time, that he lost his commissary? Those are all the ways in which he was injured, right?
Right.
Okay, and those all depend on him having been wrongly found to have cocaine rather than laundry detergent.
They depend... Well, yes,
okay.
In large part, yes. But just as a brief moment on the habeas question, I really don't think we argue that this court shouldn't even address the habeas question because it was never even dealt with below. The government never raised it. And to the extent they did raise it, they raised it in a footnote to which Mr. Skinner didn't respond. The district court didn't analyze. And it's been held repeatedly in several jurisdictions that a perfunctory raising of an issue below, particularly one as important as this, it's a dispositive issue.
Why do you say it was perfunctory? It was actually raised twice in two different motions. The government describes this as a third and independent ground. It's
and
a legal ground. This isn't a fact ground. So... something we would decide de novo anyway.
Right, but they raise it in a footnote. And
let me just see if I understand. Is your position we should not read any of your footnotes? You have a lot of footnotes in your brief. Should we not read any of them?
No, I'm not saying you can't read it. What I'm saying is that you shouldn't consider that issue here because it's a factual question that should have been raised before the district court. It is the district court that is the arbiter of those kinds of facts and wasn't given that opportunity.
That is the key question. What makes it a factual question rather than a legal question? If it is a factual question, I think you're quite right. What makes it a factual question?
The analysis of the referral form and whether or not it actually should have been included in his files, whether or not it was included in his files, and whether or not the language actually laundry detergent was properly considered by anybody.
What makes the question of whether this belongs in habeas or not a factual question? That's really the issue. The issue you don't want us to consider is whether this should go to habeas, right?
Right, whether this should sound exclusively in habeas.
Right.
Yes.
So help me as to why that's a fact question.
It's a fact question because of the factual issues that are raised that would serve as the grounds for a habeas petition. Those are all questions of fact that would have to be challenged in habeas. And if they're not raised below for the district court to consider, then Mr. Skinner is then hamstrung here before the Court of Appeals, and it's not fair to him. He's already a pro se litigant. He should have been able to argue that point, and it should have been raised as a substantive point by the government as opposed to a footnote if they seriously wanted to have the issue considered, and they did not. Therefore, the district court completely ignored it. And we are here today discussing it, and we shouldn't be, quite frankly. We recommend if that issue is going to be discussed at all, it should be remanded to the district court for the district court to discuss. The issue that is primarily of import here is the retroactive application of the exemption regulations, which is what the government wants to do. That's what the Court of Appeals sent this case back down to the district court to continue to consider, which the district court ultimately did not consider. Because this case had come up here on a notice of appeal after the district court had initially denied the motion. And then, because the district court has issued another order after Mr. Skinner did a a motion to reconsider its denial of the motion to dismiss, sent the quick case back down to consider whether or not these exemption regulations should apply, and we believe they should not. At the time, Mr. Skinner was adjudicated guilty. He had the right to sue under the Privacy Act, which because he was adjudicated guilty on January 28, 2002. The exemption regulations did not pass until August 9, 2002, well after he was adjudicated guilty. And so at that time, he had a right to sue. He, in fact, was appealing several times. He was submitting FOIA requests. He was actively pursuing his rights under the Privacy Act to make sure that he could challenge these claims. Now, the government, in its brief, and I think also, well, no, the government in its brief somehow wants to allege that the 1976 Bureau of Prisons regulations somehow apply to this case, which I think is just almost disingenuous, because there are clearly dozens of cases that have come up in this court that challenge 552A, that are 552 AE5 claims since 1976. And the 1976 regulations only apply to section C, D, portions of C, D, A, E, and G, but not E5. And to the extent they apply to D, which is the amendment, that's not the claim under which this case has been brought. And the cases on which the government relies to argue that the regulations here should, that E5 should be exempted, are not applicable to this case. They come up under D, which is the amendment provision, and we're coming up under the failure to accurately maintain the records. Secondly, the government's attempt to argue that the 1976 coupled together with the 2002 regulations should somehow warrant the exemption, we also think that claim should be barred. And in fact, it has been specifically rejected by the Ninth Circuit in Fendler. There are civil remedies that are provided in Section G, and a couple of those similar civil remedies, G1A and G1B, have been specifically exempted, and they were exempted in 1976. And they were exempted as to refer to subsection D. So the G and D are all tied together for the 1976 exemptions. Again, that does not relate to E5. And the Ninth Circuit said specifically, because the BOT did not exempt itself from E5, and because the BOP stated justification for exemption of subsection G bears no relation to E5, the BOP now has no basis for contending that it should be exempt for from E5. As I have said, we believe that these exemption regulations do not apply to Mr. Skinner. Mr. Skinner has alleged a valid and claim for damages in this case under the Privacy Act, and I have reserved the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Williams. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, Mark Nebaker here on behalf of the appellees. This is a case that, in essence, is strike three, and I don't mean that in the literal Prison Litigation Reform Act sense, but for Mr. Skinner. He has tried this once before in 2002 in the District Court of the District of Columbia. The court told him that the Rizzoli decision from this court barred him from proceeding on such a claim until he secured habeas relief. Plaintiff then tried the habeas relief. He apparently misunderstood the requirements of Rizzoli, likening it to an exhaustion at the administrative level.
Why didn't the district court say that?
I don't know.
You get what I'm asking, which is...
Yes. When the matter was briefed, we know that the issue was being reconsidered by the Supreme Court, the Heck issue, Edwards versus Balasag, in the Wilkinson v. Dodson case. Over time, I look at this case, and it seems so obvious that Edwards versus Balasag is a bar. It could have been that early on, in the early stages of the case, it wasn't sure what the future of Edwards versus Balasag and Heck were going to be, and so perhaps that's why the argument was shied away from. It's certainly obvious now after Wilkinson v. Dodson, and in light of the fact that Rizzoli remains good law, that if Mr. Skinner wishes to get the relief, that is, the finding that he was guilty of possession of drug paraphernalia overturned, he has to do that in a habeas action. He's tried and failed. And this was the third effort. We believe that the district court was correct in concluding that he failed to state a claim. It seems, and I posit that it's an easier determination when you look at the complaint. You see that the plaintiff admitted that he had failed to secure habeas relief, and that he seeks restoration of 40 days worth of good conduct time. Even in his brief on appeal, he concedes, this is the pro se appellant's brief on page 23, he concedes and almost paraphrases the language from Rosoli that a finding in his favor will result in the restoration of his good time credits. So in light of that, it seems like the simple way to resolve this is the purely legal question of when a prisoner seeks to challenge a disciplinary proceeding that has resulted in the loss of his good conduct time, he has to first go through habeas. And you can't
forfeit that argument by failing to properly raise it before the district court?
We would argue that we did not, that it was in
I'm not asking you that. You can forfeit it, right?
Well,
if you don't properly raise it.
Actually, under 12,
not something we're going to look at sua sponte.
There's a difference between do you forfeit it and will this court look at it on appeal? This court, of course, has the discretion to consider an issue raised below, but and will do so, as I understand it, most often.
Let me try again,
sir.
If we find that you did not properly raise it below, can you forfeit it? It's not like a jurisdictional matter.
I don't think it would be a jurisdictional matter.
It's not a jurisdictional
matter. I would say that that under 12H it could be raised at any time and that it would be a fruitless endeavor to send it back to have the district court look at this purely legal question.
I think your answer is yes, it can be forfeited. If we were to find that you did not properly raise it, it can be forfeited.
Although
it's not subject to
maybe you would argue forfeited for purposes of an appeal, but it is if it's a if the plaintiff has failed to state a claim, it can be raised at any time. If it was to be remanded.
A non-jurisdictional failure to state a cause of action can be raised at any time?
Well, what I'm suggesting is if the court were to remand it to the district court.
That's not what you meant to say, is it?
That
Arbar says quite the opposite.
I guess under the procedural posture.
Jurisdictional, it can't be raised to a spot. You know,
under the procedural posture of this case, you send it back to the district court, we're going to raise it again. And there's nothing to prohibit us from doing that.
I realize you do not want to answer my question, but I think I have the answer, which is, were we to find that you did not raise it, you could be barred.
Could be, but the court does have jurisdiction.
Meaning it is not jurisdictional, it is not something that we would raise sua sponte.
You're saying that if because you didn't raise it in the district court, which you deny, we won't consider it, and therefore we remand the case to the district court, you're free to raise it in the district court.
Exactly.
Right.
So you haven't waived it. Maybe you waived it for appeal, but you haven't waived it for all time.
That's what I was trying to recognize.
Why isn't it jurisdictional?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting question, Judge, because it seems to me you can always argue a failure to state a claim can be equated to failure to state a claim within the jurisdiction of the district court. I think the courts have often...
say that Heck says that this is that the jurisdiction is exclusively habeas for a claim like this.
I thought Heck went off on a 12B6 angle, Judge
which
Randolph.
Is not jurisdictional.
But I still say the plaintiff has to establish that his claim, that he has a claim that is within the jurisdiction of the court.
Makes it very clear that if you have a cause of action challenge that could have been raised and you didn't raise it, too bad.
Although the Court of Appeals does have discretion to consider an issue.
We are going to jump in. It's not fair to the other side. We're not going to jump in and say, oops, you forgot that.
Although I will
another shot, right?
I will point out this is a rare case where the plaintiff knew it up front. He actually argued it in his complaint and argued it again in his motion to amend. I understand, Your Honor.
You argue whether it was or was not preserved, but the boundaries are clear. You can waive a cause of action challenge.
I think you can, but I think this court can also exercise discretion to consider and does so most often when it's a legal
thing. But we rarely will jump in and preserve something that you haven't raised and saved.
Although it rarely, I would submit, will this court see a case where the plaintiff has been put on notice in a 2002 civil action that Rosoli's going to keep him from winning. Then
he tries habeas and loses, and he comes back and does the same thing again. And then the government puts him on notice in a footnote that was very firm. A third and independent ground for a dismissal is Rizzoli. So here's a case where even if you thought a footnote could be deemed to not exist, in essence, ignore it, and that therefore nothing was raised, nothing was reserved, this would be a good case for you to say, you know what, this would be a waste of time to send this back to the federal judge.
Does the district court have a rule that actions, arguments raised in footnotes don't count?
None that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Is there any holding of any of the district judges to that effect?
Not that I'm aware of. I would point out just a couple of things, if I may. There was an argument made.
There is a Supreme Court case on that, but it's in a dissent by Justice Douglas in a case called Tidewater Oil Company, where he dropped a footnote. Judge Garland knows this case. He dropped a footnote and said footnotes don't count.
Some are important, and some are not.
Sort of ironic.
It's kind of a double negative. Can I? I'm curious about one thing. The E5 is enforced only by a damage action?
Well, we would submit that.
Was?
You mean in federal district court? Because BOP has adopted this program statement that allows an inmate, and will allow Mr. Skinner if he wishes, to come in at any time and ask them to correct his records. They want to have accurate records. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, they're law enforcement records, and they've concluded that they shouldn't be, that a plaintiff, a litigant, or a prisoner shouldn't be able to rummage through those records.
Let me tell you what I'm wondering about is the exemption comes down on August the 9th, 2002. He doesn't file a suit. He files a suit in October of 2002 for damages, right?
I think that's correct.
Why is it that you seem to concede that to apply the exemption in the context of his lawsuit would be to apply the regulations retroactively?
Oh, I don't believe we have. We argued both that in 1976 we adopted regulations exempting G.
I'm talking about, let's just stick to the 2002.
And what we argued was, in essence, it can be a jurisdiction stripping. Redeemed a jurisdiction stripping provision because it allows the Bureau of Prisons with respect to a specific system of records to exempt itself from G, which includes the district court's jurisdiction.
Here's what I'm wondering about. Every time the Bureau of Prisons or any other agency for that matter exempts itself from the Privacy Act, it's always dealing with records that have already been created.
Exactly,
right?
Which is why you have to interpret the Privacy Act.
It cannot be. That because the records already exist when you exempt them, that therefore what you're doing is applying that regulation retroactively. That doesn't make any sense.
No, it would not make any sense for Congress to say you can protect your records unless they're old.
When is the first time that that exemption passed in August with respect to this gentleman here? The exemption promulgated in August of 2002, when is the first time it's applied? It's not applied until at the earliest October. When the lawsuit is brought, I don't see why that makes it retroactive in any way.
I believe, Judge, that the complaint in the civil action before you was filed in August of 2004. It was the earlier case with Judge Walton that was filed in 2002.
Yeah,
I don't know if that helps any, but the point is, you have. I think, as Your Honor says, it doesn't make any sense for Congress to have allowed the Bureau of Prisons or another law enforcement entity to exempt itself from the Privacy Act, access provisions, amendment provisions, without saying you can do it to records that existed in the past. And so then it becomes a question of, well, how retroactive are you going to make it? Here, I don't think you actually have to get into that because they did exempt themselves from G. I think that the Ninth Circuit got it wrong when it said, well, Congress said to give a reason, and they didn't give enough reasons.
Let's just say here you don't have to get into what because they exempted themselves from G. What did you mean to say?
I'm sorry. You don't have to get into whether or not you must, in order for the BOP to prevail or a law enforcement entity to prevail on an exemption of E5, such as the one the BOP did in 2002. You don't really have to get into that if they've adequately exempted themselves from the civil remedies provision from back in 1976 with respect to those systems of records that it could.
Not for damages.
Not if
Actually, I think so.
I guess we're perplexed as to why you're going with such a strained argument. What is it that you're nervous about?
This is not the first time you've gone with that strained argument, though, right? Like, you've raised this before, and we've never held this.
I didn't know that we had raised it before.
I thought the other side pointed out that this has been raised by the government in other cases, or at least either that or I've seen it in other cases, but never resolved one way or the other.
Or
is this the first time you thought of the idea? Then?
Well,
I guess you're in trouble either way.
Hard for me to say what was in the mind of the assistant that drafted our papers below, because I got the case after it was brief. But my sense is where you have such an easy way to resolve the case, it makes sense to do it on the Rizzoli basis. And I think that stands true, particularly since we would regard that as a purely legal question, particularly where the plaintiff has pled in his complaint that he tried habeas and lost.
Analysis is not one that you're embracing?
I believe that is an accurate analysis. That's the Fourth Circuit or Virginia District Court. The Ninth Circuit, I believe, got the issue wrong, but they prevail on one of our other theories anyway, and we think we could prevail on that theory here as well. One thing, and that is Amicus makes a big point of you shouldn't resolve this in summary judgment. Again, you don't need to because you've got the purely legal question. But there was a Fox v. Strickland order, a Fox Neal order issued in the case. I think it's docket 33. And so plaintiff was aware. And he also recites the standard for summary judgment in his opposition and/or his motion to amend. For those reasons, the reasons we gave in our brief, we would submit that the court should affirm the district.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Williams, your rebuttal. How much time does Ms. Williams have?
2.5 minutes.
Okay, we'll give you a whole 3 minutes.
Okay, great, thank you. Just as a preliminary matter, I want to reiterate that the habeas issue should be waived. The government has waived that issue. And I want to point the court specifically to Muhammad v. Close, which is a Supreme Court case at 540 U.S. 749, 2004 case, where a prisoner, just like Mr. Skinner, bought his action, and the government didn't raise the habeas question until the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said, you've waived it.
Yeah, but that's
we're not
going to
raise
that's
it
not
here.
The question before us. It was raised in footnotes. Did the Supreme Court say that raising it in a footnote is not good enough? It was
no.
Raised in this court,
right.
And it was in the brief, right?
It was raised in a footnote, but it certainly wasn't raised.
In this court, it was raised fully in the brief.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
And in the district court, it was raised in two motions in footnotes.
Yes, but it was not thoroughly raised. And the Tenth Circuit and the First Circuit have said that that a single footnote is an issue that issues that are reverted to in a perfunctory manner, like a footnote, unaccompanied by some effort at developed argumentation, are deemed waived. And those
we
are
thought, I mean, what they said is that this case is squarely decided by Balasag. That's what they said in the footnote. If we agree that this case is squarely decided by Balasag, there's almost nothing else to say.
Well, I don't think the case is squarely decided by Balasag. And if it was squarely decided by Balasag, they should have briefed it then, because Balasag was decided in the 90s. This case didn't come up until in the 2000s. So they had plenty of opportunity to brief the cases. The Balasag was the law of the land at the time this case was raised. So, and I don't think notwithstanding whether Balasag is raised, the government has waived it. But if we want to talk about Balasag,
and what about Rizzoli? Why isn't it decided by Rizzoli? That's our own case.
The probabilistic theory?
Yeah. We've upheld that. You realized that a couple weeks ago we upheld the probabilistic theory again.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding Wilkins.
Right. No, I understand that. Because I just think that I think the case law supports, including the Seventh Circuit case, which I will refer to again. It's called Veens v. I'll get you the specific thing. Veens v. Daniels, which is at 871 F. 2nd 1328, which basically talks about there are different forms of punishment. And a prisoner should not be foreclosed or forced solely into habeas just because his good time credits have been taken away from him. He has a right to challenge under the damages action, under the Privacy Act, which he has a right to do.
This is really the same question I was asking you in the beginning, which is, it's true that the remedy may be different, but the ground for the remedy appears to be the same. So that if you undercut the ground for the remedy with respect to something other than good time, you're also undercutting the ground for the remedy with respect to good time.
But that doesn't mean that I don't think that just if you undercut one, that doesn't mean you're foreclosed from raising the other. Okay, you do, maybe you do undercut the good times, but that doesn't mean he can't raise the damages action. Because we would argue that solitary confinement is a very, very significant penalty for what may be an incorrect finding. So
reduction of good time is a pretty bad penalty for the same thing, isn't it?
If you're already in prison for as long as Mr. Skinner's going to be in prison, I would argue that solitary confinement is worse. Because 45 days and his 15-20-year sentence is not, you know, it's a month on 15 years. It's not going to make that big of a difference. Solitary confinement, I argue, would.
You probably don't want him to hear you say that.
Well, that's true. That's true. But we're talking about different penalties, and I think that it's – okay. All right.
I got you.
All right. Do I have more time? Or no?
Yeah, you have 41 seconds.
Okay, well, good. I'm sorry. Finally, I just want to reply to the government saying that the G exemption applies here. It doesn't.
This is on the question of whether they can exempt themselves from our jurisdiction, right?
Yes. The G exemption applies to subsection D, which is the motion to amend. That is not what's at issue here. And that's what the Bureau of Prisons said and explained in the Federal Register in 1976 when it passed those exemption regulations. So for the government to rely on that exemption is just not correct. Finally, we believe, and I'll say again, that Mr. Skinner has alleged at a motion to dismiss as a pro se litigant that he has stated a claim for damages under the Privacy Act, and he should be allowed to bring those claims and at least have the district court consider these claims. If we go back to the district court, if the government wants to raise the habeas issue there, then they're more than happy to raise it again. But the district court is the person or the court that is to hear these issues in the first instance and the factual issues. And I think that the referral form that
Williams, it seems to me the harder argument you have apart from habeas is the Williams v. Farr argument. That is, that it's nothing more than an inchoate right. And once the government, once BOP elects to exempt it, forget the 1976.
Right.
They have clearly exempted it now, and his claim was not processed until after the exemption. He didn't really have anything to rest on.
No, but I think
that analysis isn't.
I think Williams v. Farr is inapplicable to this case. In Williams v. Farrier, the incident in question happened in June 2002, just before the exemption regulations. He wasn't actually found guilty of anything until August 15, 2002, which is after the exemption regulations had been passed. So his right was inchoate at the time that the exemption regulations passed. Mr. Skinner, on the other hand, had been found guilty, had done his solitary confinement time, had his commissary privileges had been taken away. His rights were solidified. He had begun his appeals through the BOP. Williams v. Farr doesn't apply in this case. I think what applies in this case is Cherry v. Barnhart, if we're going to look at district court cases, which is a Social Security Administration case where the Social Security Administration issued regulations changing the definition of disability, and the court basically said it would be applied illegally retroactively to pending claims because those claims were filed based upon the old definition of disability, and to apply those regulations retroactively would unfairly deny those claimants the rights. And we think that's the same situation that's happening to Mr. Skinner. So we would argue that because he's alleged a claim for damages, that he should be entitled to at least go back to the district court to have his day in court and present those damages claims effectively.
All right, Ms. Williams, thank you very much. You were appointed by the court as amicus. We appreciate very much your efforts on behalf of the client.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Case is submitted.